Originally a cheap, plentiful, and man-made substitute for ivory, celluloid, one of the earliest of plastics, made its way into the manufacture of novelties. But it had one serious defect. It could burn.
Welcome to the Kill It With Fire podcast, where each episode, a group of creative practitioners and academics from different disciplines takes a look at cult, neglected or overlooked motion pictures from the last few decades of celluloid, when movies were films.
Revenge is a dish best served cold. That's the tagline of the film we're going to be discussing today, which is Bob Giraldi's Dinner Rush from 2000, released in 2001 in America. I'm not entirely sure when it was released over here in the UK. I think it went straight to home video, but it did get a sort of a small theatrical release in America, apparently. Round of introductions. Peter, would you like to introduce yourself?
Peter True, skipper, boat owner, Quint wannabe.
Fantastic, Nikki.
How can I beat that introduction? I'm Nikki Mabbitt. I am photographer, random film enthusiast, and general minion.
I know, Paul Lewis, and I'll be your maitre d'. I was going to say this evening, but this morning. Same thing, innit? So, first encounters with Dinner Rush. I'm looking at Peter. I'm going to guess Peter's going to say yesterday.
No, a couple of weeks ago, when I was rushing through. I've got to get this marking
Dinner
done.
Rush, rushing
got to get this marking done. Got to get that film
should
watched.
Do a sequel called Marking Rush.
Yeah. And then we came in and the radio studio was broken.
Yeah. So you would have watched it. So your first time watching Dinner Rush was when I said to you, watch this film, Peter.
First time
watcher. I did it in two halves because obviously parenting life.
That feeling.
You can never get anything done in one go. So I finished it. I started it Tuesday, finished it last night.
Great, yeah. I'll admit, I've not seen Dinner Rush until fairly recently, the last couple of years. I think it slipped off my radar, I think, because the UK DVD copy, the cover of it looks just like a generic sort of, quite bland movie. I was pleasantly surprised when I watched it for the first time. But yeah, we'll talk a bit more about that later. But yeah, so I'd only seen it for the first time in the last couple of years. I certainly didn't see it when it first came out. In terms of a synopsis, Dinner Rush begins with the murder of Enrico, who's the business associate of Louis Cropa, the character played by Danny Aiello. Danny Aiello's character, Louis, is a restaurant owner, former... I always get bookkeeper and bookmaker mixed up. Former bookmaker, which Enrico still has dibs in. Enrico's killed by these two, set in Tribeca, the film. Killed by these two mobsters from Queens. There's Carmen and there's Paolo, isn't there? Who's doesn't speak a word of English. The typical sort of Italian-American... Well, the typical Italian-imported murderer, hitman.
Yes.
That you get. I mean, there's one in The Sopranos, isn't there? I've forgotten his name, the guy with the longer hair. And they bring him in to do all the whack jobs. Whack jobs? Wet work? Is that what they call it? I don't know. Yeah. I'm not a gangster.
Whack,
I don't know.
Whacking
the folks.
Gotta whack him off.
So these two guys want to put the screws on Louis Cropa to take his restaurant away from him because he's also got an employee. Duncan.
Duncan,
Kirk Acevedo. Duncan, who's in debt to them for... Well, he puts another bet on partway through the film. Eventually, it's $13,000. So they're hoping to use that as pressure, leverage, to persuade Louis to give them his restaurant. And they're going to use it... Well, their plan is to use it for bookmaking, not bookkeeping.
Not bookkeeping, no.
I'm sure he keeps some good books as part of the restaurant, but not as a legitimate business, as a front for nefarious mobster-related activities, gambling activities. Amidst that, we've got a number of other characters. We've got Louis' son Udo, who's the chef who himself hopes to inherit the restaurant. There's Sean, who's the bartender, weirdly British bartender in this Tribeca restaurant. We have, that's played by Jamie Harris. We've got Gabriel in the kitchen, Adamir, who's the maitre d', another waiter, Machine, Piper, another waitress. And we've got Marty, who I think is a really interesting character, who's one of the waitresses. Mm. And she's also, it's her art that decorates the restaurant, because she has an interesting encounter with the art critic, Fitzgerald. My goal is plays Fitzgerald, the art critic, snobby art critic, and Marty eventually makes him aware that it's her art that he's been sort of semi-admiring, if you like, on the walls.
It'd have been better if he had the little bell, because I couldn't stop thinking about Breaking Bad.
Yeah, he's not really playing against type, is he? It's sort of the type of character that he plays in numerous things.
Yeah.
Margolis. But yeah, so that's the synopsis, and it all resolves itself at the end. These various narrative strands come together at the end in a way that maybe I won't reveal. Maybe we'll talk about it later. I don't know. I don't want to spoil it too much. So in terms of production and release, did you find anything out about the production and release, Peter, or...?
No, just that it was filmed in 21 days. It's the restaurant is the owned by the director,
Bob Giraldi. Yeah. Bob Giraldi, the director, is quite a restaurateur. I think he owns, don't know if he still does, but certainly at that time he owned a number of restaurants, I think, or co-owned a number of restaurants. This was filmed in his own restaurant in Tribeca, which is Gigino Trattoria. It's also a director of numerous music videos.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Hall and Oates and Pat Benatar, Paul McCartney, Lionel Richie, directed a lot of music videos. It's 11 restaurants he owned at one point, which is quite sort of incredible, really. And you do get, I think, in the space of this, you get a real sense of a functioning restaurant, don't you? It's clearly not a studio set, because you've got the kitchen, you've got the toilets. Where a lot of action happens.
Yeah, that was surprising, and it does have that vibe. It's like you're there. It's very realistic.
It's got a very strong sense of the realistic operation of a restaurant, I think. It was shot in 2000, but released in 2001 after 9/11. And there was some debate about, because there's some shots of the World Trade Center in the opening title sequence, isn't there, as sort of background. And Giraldi described it as a pre-war movie. That was, quote, a pre-war movie made in New York. Again, quote, when the mood and the concept and the attitude was entirely different. And he did give an interview with the New York Times where he talks about sort of sitting around with a distribution company and said, quote, you're there, what do you feel? He said, I feel somber, I feel sad. But no, he thinks it's strategically smart to release this movie shot in the heart of the war zone, as he calls it, with three shots of the World Trade Center. The deciding factor was, let's release it because we plan to release it. Why don't we be one of the first to do what we plan to do? Because you remember at the time there was some changes made to Spider-Man and all sorts, wasn't there, to remove the World Trade Center. And this film was made by, I think they were five blocks away from the incident, I think the restaurant. And so, as I say, Giraldi and the distributor decided to leave the film as is, if you like. Which is, I think, is quite different to the big Hollywood model. Giraldi had only directed one other TV movie in 85. Two TV movies in 85 and 86, City Boy and Club Med. There's one other theatrical feature before this, Hiding Out, which I haven't seen, from 1987, with John Cryer and Annabeth Gish. But Giraldi and Danny Aiello were quite good friends, apparently. They'd known each other since 1978, and I think they've worked on a lot of adverts together for American TV, which Danny Aiello, if you look at sort of compilations of American ads, he seems to crop up a lot in American ads in the 80s and the 90s, doesn't he? The other thing about this is that it was sort of made in that wave of interesting sort of mob stories, I think, after The Sopranos, which was 98, I think The Sopranos started, yeah. Wasn't it? So, sort of very, these sort of indie movies about mobsters and so on and so forth. And Giraldi, cast aspersions, but it appears that he knew that world quite well from the inside, because he said in some interviews that I found he had an uncle. That's,
he I might, was going to say
bunker. He might well have had a bunker and a bunker, but he had an uncle that he spoke about in the interviews. And his uncle, he said, was a bookmaker. They said bookkeeper again. because he was a bookkeeper, he'd be completely irrelevant. No, he said that he had an uncle that was a bookmaker, and he also said that one of the things that he added to the script, which was written by a couple of other guys, Rick Shaughnessy and Brian Escalante, who I haven't done an awful lot apart from this, if you look at the credits, but one of the things that Giraldi added to that script was the sort of the mob dialogue, if you like. So I assume all the stuff with Danny Aiello talking to his bookkeeper, Gary, his accountant Gary, and, you know, discussing the ins and outs of gangsterism. Mobsterism with Carmen and Paola and various other characters. So I assume a lot of that, from what Giraldi says, was what Giraldi added to the movie. Going back to Shaughnessy and Collata, this is the only feature film that both have written. Collata's works largely as a location manager on TV. He's got a long list of credits as a location manager on TV shows. And the original script, apparently, by Shaughnessy and Collata, focused predominantly on the restaurant business. So I don't know if the whole stuff with the mob was an add-on by Giraldi or whether it was there bubbling away in the original script or not, but certainly the information that I read suggested that the original script was largely focused on the restaurant business. The other thing that Giraldi built into the script was details of Italian-American life. The intergenerational relationships, he credits himself with, you know, that relationship between Louis and his son Udo, and the conflict that they get into, because Udo's not happy because Louis has Kirk Acevedo's character, Duncan, the other chef in the kitchen. He has Duncan prepare his meals because he likes old-school food. And Udo's sort of nouveau cuisine, isn't it? That Udo's made this restaurant into a thriving thing by boinking. Is that the word? the food critic?
Yeah.
Because there's Jennifer Freely, the food critic's Sandra Bernhardt's character, but there's also the character called the food nymph, who I think is another food critic. When I watched this again for this, I got those two characters kind of mixed up. I think, which one has Duncan boinked?
Yeah, everybody by the looks of it, because just when they go, well, like, it's another person. That's
Andy Cole as well, because there's this love triangle, isn't there, between Duncan and Udo and Nicole, who's the front of house staff. She takes the bookings and stuff.
They should be too busy for all that. Yeah,
it's all that cooking in the kitchen. And I'm throwing my hands up in the air in a very Larry David style at the moment. I think it's hard to sort of get that across in an audio way, isn't it?
It's funny because I drive a Fiat 500, and apparently when I'm driving and I'm talking, I get very expressive. And the partner said, it was like you're taking the Italian thing too far, because I'm going like this.
I think Nicky was like, you hit the microphone that time.
I'm doing it now. It's especially when you watch a gangster movie or even The Sopranos. Hey. Going like,
forget about it. And also built in a lot of those elements from his own career as a restaurateur. And like you say, it's got a real sense of verisimilitude, hasn't it? I think these depictions of the restaurant business. Giraldi said, quote, everything in there, right down to the chefs and the womanising and the fucking in the corner. It's a lovely way of putting it, isn't it?
It's beautiful.
I think I put it in a better way. It's all based in truth, and a lot of it is autobiographical. And the subplot of the mob trying to muscle in on the restaurant was also something that was based on Giraldi's own experiences as a restaurateur. So that's what I've got about the production and sort of the release history of the film. There's not a massive amount out there, but there's enough there to sort of gauge that the original script seems to have been reworked quite considerably by Giraldi to work in those elements of realism and the gangsterism, if you like, that was du jour in the era post that first season of The Sopranos. It's hard to sort of get that across, like trying to explain to my kids how popular sort of mob movies and stuff were post the first season of The Sopranos.
Well, I mean, that plays into one of the key things in the film, which I don't know, we might talk about later, the fact that, you know, the subterfuge of the mob involvement in the restaurant in the first place.
Using legitimate businesses as...
Well, no, the fact that the restaurant owner sort of lets it be assumed, and he plays up to the idea that he was in the mob.
Oh, yeah.
But in fact, he wasn't.
At the end, he didn't, then
was he?
Yeah. I think that's worth mentioning, Peter. I mean, we're getting into analysis now, but I think, you know, the whole sort of mob myth thing is where it's engaged with here, isn't it? Because, you know, at one point, Udo, at the end of the film, or towards the end of the film, Udo says to Louis, this gangster business sucks. You people are fucking ridiculous. I'm trying to put some passion into this, as I'm saying. you people are fucking ridiculous, he says. And Louis says, and he's referring to the sort of high society types and Jennifer Freely and the food critic and the art types, you know.
The bougie people.
Yeah, the stuck-ups upstairs. He says, judging by your folks upstairs, I'd say we're a dead heat, he says in response. Mm. And then he tells, at the end of the movie, or towards the end of the movie, he tells Louis tells Udo that he's gifting Udo the business. He says, I still want my table in the corner to do business at. What kind of business is he going to do with this table in the corner? Anyway.
Dessert tasting.
Yeah, tasting the pudding. Yeah. But he says, the restaurant's yours. And he says, you know, I'm proud of you for being able to cook, for being, you know, able to teach and for being able to understand, not to follow in your daddy's footsteps in a life of sort of borderline criminality.
But the whole thing of that myth of the gangster mob thing, it's sort of at the end of the film, people are, I can't remember who it was, but they're sort of talking in the aftermath of the murders, and they're like, oh, only you could have, like, you know, a double murder and it'll actually triple your business.
That's Feely, isn't it? That's Bernhard's character, yeah. And I think that should be the tagline, really. It's like, only in New York does a double murder triple a restaurant business. I think that's a great line. That should have been the tagline, I think, rather than Revenge is a Dish Best Served Goal, maybe.
Yeah, because it's a bit, I found it a bit cliche.
It is, yeah. It's just like a charming sort of phrase, isn't it? I mean, but the other thing Louis says to Natalie, who's Enrico's... What's going on with Louis and Natalie? That's what I want to know. Enrico's daughter... Because like Enrico's killed in the street. The claim Enrico's 59. Well, he's not 59. I mean, you know, I'm like mid-40s. I'm like on the way to 59.
Oh yeah, thinking he's not 59.
If that guy's 59, I've got good genetics.
Yeah, made me feel good.
but his daughter, played by Natalie, played by Polly Draper.
That was weird.
Yeah, because he's sort of hitting on her, isn't he? That's the impression I get. I don't know.
And she's loving it. Like, and she's like,
she likes being hit on by her father's like elderly friend.
Yeah, it's weird. It is weird as well, because afterwards you're like, well, did he take the desserts?
Because he's going to take a chocolate pudding, isn't he? The best chocolate pudding they've got.
Don't leave those in the car. It'll be terrible.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, I'm not quite sure what's going on there. Whether he's
I suppose that's one of the reviews that I read was talking about how you don't have time to fully express all these characters. You know, you can't go into full depth in all of these characters because it's such an ensemble piece. Mm-hmm. But I suppose it works so well that ambiguity, that non-explanation, it still works really well, doesn't it? They all feel like complete characters, even though you don't know what's going on there, and it's not fully explained.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of intersection of all those narrative threads. I mean, I've listed in my notebook like some of the different narrative threads. There's obviously Enrico's murder and the fallout for both Louis, Natalie and Lucy in terms of grief, because it's Enrico's Louis' friend, but it's Natalie's father and Lucy's grandfather, but also the fallout for the business and so on and so forth. There's the intrusion of Carmen and Paolo, and their threat to the restaurant, and their existential threat to Duncan, because they're going to whack Duncan, so they say. Yeah. And Louis eventually gives him the money, doesn't he? And Duncan, the $13,000, and said, give that to them. And he says, you know, if you gamble again, I'm going to break your fucking legs. You know, I'm trying to sort of do my Danny Aiello impersonation. It's not very good, that one. But anyway, he said, you know, if I catch you doing it again, I'll break your legs personally, doesn't he?
Mm.
And so there's that threat represented by Carmen and Paolo. There's Duncan's relationship with Nicole, who's also involved with Udo. But Udo seems to be boinking everybody in the restaurant, I think, because isn't there an implication as well that he's had a relationship with Marty, I think, and maybe Piper?
I can't remember Piper. Lost count, because there's a point where they're just coming up the stairs going,
Another one. And obviously Jennifer Freely, Sandra Bernhardt, and he's making eyes at the food nymph, the critic that she brings in. So that sort of theme of sexual jealousy or rivalry, isn't there?
Yeah. You got the nice guy at the bar.
You got Sean at the bar, and his sort of trick of knowing everything in the world. When people throw sort of general knowledge questions at him, he can answer those. Because there's a power cut, and that's how he entertains the customers for tips, isn't it? By answering, you know, all sorts of random, like, where do the flies go in winter, and, you know, why Holden Jeff
Caulfield should have gone to that restaurant and he'd have found out where the ducks go.
Exactly. Maybe that's the sequel. You've got Udo and his relationship with Feely and the food nymph, as I mentioned earlier. That's another thread that's picked up on. Marty serving at the table of Fitzgerald, the art critic, and the Greek artist that's at the table with him, whose name I've forgotten. Can you remember the Greek artist's name?
Was it Gabriel?
Gabriel, yeah, it was. Yeah, the Gabriel. Oh, Gabriel. Anyway, but thank you, Peter. Thank you. I normally write, when the characters are first introduced, I write them in my notes in capitals, which is what I was looking for there. Then I just realised I was just really tired and the text wasn't like... It was just rolling about in a sea of tiredness because I was up late last night. But yeah, Gabriel. Fitzgerald's cruel treatment of Marty because she's just a waitress. I did air quotes around that. That's again, yes. Another thing that's difficult. And just a waitress. But he eventually realises that she's also an artist, because we know that, because when the restaurant is preparing for opening at the start of the film, she goes around tidying up her artworks, doesn't she, on the wall. So we know she's a bit fussy about it. Is she a bit fussy about that? Because that's hers.
Yeah.
So again, it's like not judging a book by its cover. There's the subplot of Duncan's debts as well, and his gambling addiction, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah,
he can't stop himself gambling.
And I suppose not judging a book by its cover, the John Corbett character at the bar.
Ken. Yeah, the guy that turns out to be the hitman. Sorry, what have I done?
Spoiler alert.
He turns out to be a hitman that Louis hired to whack Carmen and Paolo in the toilets.
Mm.
Or just outside the toilets, I think, one of them, isn't it?
Do you know what I liked about that, though? When he meets the lady at the bar and he says about working in Wall Street. Then they mention it again at the end, so he's like, because you think it's a lie.
Yeah.
I was just a hitman, and then I mentioned it again, and he's like, "Nice guy, works
on
Wall Street."
Well, I think that ties into the sort of ruthlessness, doesn't it, as well? That sort of, well, I hear Wall Street, and I think of Gordon Gekko, and I think of Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sort of,
yeah.
For me, that was a bit of a hint that he was there was a darker side to that character. John Corbett plays that character, doesn't he? Yeah. I mean, you know, look at Corbett's credits.
Yeah, he's amazing. As soon as I saw him, I was like, oh, I'm going to love this.
Yeah. And he has some good interaction with Sean, doesn't he, at the bar. So,
yeah,
you know,
he's amazing. Underrated, I think. Fantastic. So lovely. Man Crush 753.
I was going to say Man Crush there.
Well, it was funny because I was just looking up before we were starting there. The Duncan character reminded me a lot of Adam Arkin, who's in Northern Exposure, that's where I know John from, as the chef. They think he's Bigfoot in Northern Exposure, and he turns out to be this gourmet chef. But it's not. So there you go, that's a useless bit of information. Went down a rabbit hole there.
But the whole thing with Ken as well is that Louis resorts to violence, and prior to that moment he said, he's gone on a number of rants about never having used violence in his sort of association with the bookmaking, not bookkeeping, bookmaking.
Those
are violent accountants. Never having used violence in his... He says, 25 years. Why am I doing that? Why am I doing a stupid accent? 25 years. Nobody's got killed, he says at one point, doesn't he? And, of course, he's hired Ken, and Ken's been hanging around to whack. For wet work.
Wet call work.
It. Yeah. To whack...
Wet work in the toilets,
yeah. And, I mean, he talks about... And this is what makes me think, you know, when Louis's talking about gangsterism, and he's he says, he sort of implies that there weren't really gangsters, but you get the impression that there were. But this is the way that the mob operates, is it, like the mafia, like the organised crime often operates, is that they often see themselves as legitimate businessmen, offering legitimate sort of things like protection or, you know, or so on, the protection rackets and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's what they call, sometimes call it the intreccio, which is when they're looking at the mafia in Sicily, in Italy. The intreccio is the interweaving of, like, legitimate businesses and illegal, nefarious sort of activities. And how, when you're trying to tackle organised crime in Italy, what the struggle with the mafia, the Cosa Nostra, was separating, you know, the legitimate from the illegitimate, because they were so interwoven, much like the bookmaking and the restaurant itself. So, you know, whatever Louis says, he was involved in criminal activities and an element of organised crime. And, you know, people in the mafia or the Cosa Nostra will always say that it doesn't exist, because, you know. But that's even tackled in the dialogue, isn't it, when Louis's talking about Carmen and Paolo, and he says that what's the line that he says about they just see themselves as entrepreneurs, don't see themselves as mobsters. They just see themselves as entrepreneurs, and that's how Louis kind of sees himself, isn't it? If you think about it, and he obviously he's got the connections to know to get Ken. To think Barbie's Ken now, to get Ken because of Barbie, Barbenheimer over the summer, isn't it?
That'd be an interesting hitman.
Can you imagine Ken as a hitman? Ken as it. That's a sequel that should be made. But yeah.
No, I don't think he's got the balls.
Yeah. but that detective as well that Louis invites, it just, you know, to conveniently witness this whole sort of business with Carmen and Paolo. He says you'd never get, you talk about the other monsters, you'd never give them up. It's a code. And Louis says you still believe in that shit, don't you? So there's this sort of whole engagement with the myths, if you like, of the Cosa Nostra, the mafia, so to speak. And you know, Louis says to Nicole, is it Nicole at one point? You know, it's to Natalie. So he says, we weren't saints. We were just a couple of guys trying to make a few bucks. There was no family, no mob. It was all just an illusion. But that's the kind of thing that mob guys say. And I think this is all what Giraldi works into the script. I think, you know, it's all this sort of very. Very authentic. You get the sense that he knows the mob as well as he knows restaurants. I'm not implying that Bob Giraldi is some sort of gangster, but certainly you get the feeling that. But I suppose maybe running an Italian American restaurant in Tribeca, or, you know, anywhere in New York, you probably do come up against the mob. You know, pre 2000, you know, that sort of whole gentrification of New York. You get the impression that, you know, all the restaurants had sort of mob dealings at some point, don't you, really?
But that's what I found interesting, what he was saying about you still believe in that shit. It's that juxtaposition of the traditional Italian culture versus the, you know, the new bougie restaurant approach, and there's that battle. But then he's sort of modern in some of his ways, saying, "Oh, that shit doesn't exist." But
yeah,
at the same time, he still wants his sausage and peppers.
I was going to say it's all wrapped up in the food, isn't it? You know, yeah. that you know, when he's asking Duncan to prepare him sort of traditional sort of sausage meatballs, and you know, and what he sees as traditional food, but that's traditional sort of Italian-American food. It's not traditional Italian food. What Udo's cooking is traditional Italian food, isn't it?
Or
closer to it in some ways. So it's quite interesting that. I mean, there's a tension between sort of what you might call the Via Vecchia, the old way, and Il Vino Nuovo, the new way, if you like. And that's kind of represented throughout the film, isn't it? You know, in terms of the old way with the gangsters and the new way with Carmen and Paolo has been sort of ruthless. They're from Queens, aren't they? You know, ruthless and sort of unafraid to put the muscle on people, whereas Danny Aiello is a bit more, his generation of gangsters are a bit more civilised, should we say? Is that the right word to use? A bit more nuanced, perhaps? I don't know. You get that in Goodfellas, don't you, with, you know, a lot of mob movies. Well, I mean, Goodfellas is a classic example. The juxtaposition of the music in Goodfellas between the rock and roll that Henry Hill's generation is associated with, and the sort of the operetta that you know, some of the older characters, Paul Sorvino's character and so on, are associated with. So, Peter, you were going to say something?
I was just going to say that the opening, which a little bit reminded me of Reservoir Dogs, you know, the sort of talking around a table about nothing but introducing the characters and situation, that was all comparing the old and the new sort of mob, wasn't it? Like, oh, the stupid nicknames they've got now, Black and Blue or whatever they're called.
What happened to the old nicknames? Yeah. Like, my dad always tells me a story about, well, that wasn't a mobster, but when he came to Cleethorpes, and there was a character that he told me about, this guy that they knew called, we used to call him Mad Jack. And I said, why'd you call him Mad Jack? Then, well, because his name was Jack and he was mad. But it's those kind of mobs, you know, one leg Tony, or, you know, there's, what was, is it Goodfellas where he got Paulie two times because he says everything twice? Yeah. That sort of thing. So, but yeah, he said, what happened to the old nicknames? Yeah, that's that whole discussion.
That should have been our introduction. We should have made our own Cranks names.
Yeah, we should have.
I feel like I've missed a trick there.
Ah, maybe next time. But there's that whole sort of depiction of ethnic identity as sort of being tied to, and cultural identity, not just in terms of ethnicity, but also age being tied to food, I think. Yeah, because what does Louis say? He's talking about Udo's menu. He says, you call this shit food? It's a sort of hot cuisine, high cuisine menu,
upside
isn't it?
Down lobsters.
Yeah, like little pea on the plate surrounded by a sauce and that kind of thing. This place used to smell like heaven. These people wouldn't know food if it hit them in the ass. Put a meatball on their plate and they think it was a miniature bowling ball, he says at one point. But again, like I say, I mean, I think that whole sort of ethnic identity and food thing's quite interesting. I've got a friend that's of Jamaican heritage, and he often is spoken sort of quite recently about, you know, the way that Jamaican food's sort of corrupted by supermarkets and stuff. And I said, well, look at Italian food, look at like French cuisine, and look at how, you know, it's not anything new. I mean, you look at like our idea of Italian food is sort of Louis' idea of Italian, which is Italian American. It's pizza. It's, you know, meatballs in sauce. I mean, the Italians don't cook bolognese in sauce. We know this, you know. But you know, if you cook spaghetti bolognese, you do it the American way, don't you? With like loads of tomato sauce. It's not the Italian bolognese, you know, because you don't cook that in. You cook the meat in its own juices, you know. Did you watch that Stanley Tucci series about? That was really good, wasn't it?
No, I did. I heard about it.
Should be on the iPlayer. It's worth watching. It's dead good. But I mean, this is that whole sort of authenticity and inauthenticity as well. Big night with Stanley Tucci. We'll go back to Tucci and Monk. Tony Shalhoub. Have you ever seen Big Night? I love that movie from the mid-90s. No. It's about two brothers, and it's set in the 50s. And this film reminded me a lot of it, which is probably why I like this so much. But it's set in the 50s about these two brothers that they're Italian, or the first generation immigrants, and they run a restaurant. And Stanley Tucci's sort of integrated, but Tony Shalhoub's character hasn't. So Tony Shalhoub's the chef, and Stanley Tucci's sort of front of house in this restaurant and stuff. And Tony Shalhoub's character just wants to cook Italian dishes, like pure Italian dishes. That's his identity. And Stanley Tucci's character is aware that in order to sort of serve a market and build a customer base, they have to adapt the menu so it sort of absorbs elements of the local culture, if you like. And Tony Shalhoub's character sees that as a corruption of his art of cooking. Mm-hmm. And there's Ian Holm plays this gangster that's a bit like Cameron and Paolo, is sort of trying to take off, because he sees this restaurant that these two brothers own trying to take their restaurant off them, or destroy the business because it's a competition. If you ever get the chance to watch Big Night, there's a great scene where Stanley Tucci cooks eggs for his brother, and it's just it's like a planned sequence. It goes on for like 5 or 10 minutes. It's just cooking eggs, but it's all about these two brothers reconciling, and sort of towards the end of the film, after the differences that they've had, they reconcile over cooking eggs. And nobody says a word in that sequence, I don't think, as I recall, but it's such a, I mean, more recently as well, I love Big Night. Check out Big Night, it's an incredible film. Hard to get hold of these days, I think. But also, maybe we should do a podcast on that one, actually. But also, have you seen The Bear, the TV show, which is very similar? Some Disney Plus at the moment, FX show. Have you heard about it?
I've heard about it.
It's really good. Check that out. Because, again, it's similar issues. It's, it's not brothers in this instance. It's cousins. And they're competing over running this restaurant. And the main character is the protagonist. Has come from a background as a proper chef, like a trained chef. But his cousin wants to run the business more like a small deli, do you know what I mean? And it's this clash between, again, it's La Via Vecchia and Il Vino Nuovo. It's the old way and the new way, you know. And it's something that crops up time and time again, I think, in mobster stories, but also stories about restaurants and food and so on and so forth. And it's sort of, you know, I think it's quite an interesting theme. It's one of those perennially relevant themes, is how cultural identity, if you like, not just ethnic identity, but cultural identity is anchored by things like food, by things like conversation, by things like, you know, well, things like accent as well, even, you know, nicknames, as they say at the start of the movie. And I think this is what Dinner Rush is about. That's why I think it appeals to me, I think, because it's quite a fascinating topic, that one, I think. And also you've got the depiction of the kitchen. It's very macho as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And did you see Boiling Point with Stephen Graham? Set in the kitchen, all in
one take. Yeah.
Really good film. But again, I think I watched that after I watched this for the first time and I thought, I wonder. Because the whole sort of depiction of the kitchen interactions between Udo and Duncan and the other kitchen staff sort of reminded me very much of Boiling Point. I wondered if, you know, I can't remember who made Boiling Point, but if this was a reference point, perhaps, for that. Because there's BBC, I haven't seen the BBC series yet. 4 parts, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
It's on the iPlayer, I shall watch it at some point. But yeah, kitchens and high-pressure environments, where Udo comes in straight away, doesn't he? He fires one of the trainees and Duncan sort of...
really bad for him, actually.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it? What is it for?
It's over chives.
It's over chives, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And Duncan comes in, he has a go at another, he says, mise en place, put all the everything, all this shit's got to be in its right place. You know, and it's again, it all feels very authentic. You can see Giraldi's own experience, I think, as a restaurateur coming into, you know, it's the kind of, you could simulate it, I think, through research, but you can see somebody who's got direct experience of running a business like that.
Definitely.
I mean, I should show this to me. I mean, Mum worked in kitchens for most of her life, to be honest, so I should show this to her. I don't think she's seen it. But yeah, that sense of authenticity in the depiction of the restaurant life, I think, is appealing as well.
Mm.
I was said, when I was a kid, one of my dreams, I wanted to do stand-up comedy. That didn't happen. Well, you might call some of my lectures stand-up comedy, because, you know. But I wanted to write, so that sort of happened. The other thing I wanted to do as a kid is I wanted to run a little cafe that was going to be called Eggs and Things. And it was just like cooking egg dishes, like omelettes and, you know, poached eggs on toast. And
I feel like that's got to be your retirement.
I think that's what I might
be wanting. We'll all come and do a podcast on eggs and things.
I might have a bookmaker, but both.
It'll all be a ruse.
A little little table in the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little table in the corner. Well, you know, shoot the bees and we'll talk about nicknames and stuff. Drink my beer.
Wine glasses.
That kitchen, it's such a macho environment, I think, as well, isn't it? I think. I mean, Nicky, I'm going to point to you as
like... But I imagine that's kind of what it's like. I mean, obviously, very different now, but thinking about the time that it was set and that kind of culture.
Yeah. They even reference it a number of times in the dialogue, don't they, about how macho that environment is. And the maitre d', who's gay, comes down and the sort of throw slurs at him, don't they? And he says, what does he say about... I can't remember the line that he says, but he takes it quite well, doesn't he? Because obviously they respect each other, but it's still...
He takes quite a lot of crap, that guy, to be
fair. He does. I feel really sorry for the maitre d', because at the start of the movie, he's been shown how to sort of present, pronounce the... is it Marty showing him how to pronounce some of the Italian dishes? You know, it reminded me of the opening of American Psycho, you know, with I know it's French dishes in American Psycho, but the restaurant scene where you've got the blood, the sauce dripping on the plate looks like blood, and it cuts back to the guy saying, no, the special of the day is da 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 da. I mean, maybe I've not been in enough restaurants that my only sort of reference point for being in a sort of a posh, swanky restaurant is American Psycho, really. But, yeah, maybe I should stop eating at like the local takeaway or whatever, and start going to. I have been in restaurants, by the way. That was just a sort of humorous aside. I should, you know, I have a little bit more cultured than that.
But you've got to drizzle your ketchup on the side in like a little swoosh.
Yeah,
like
that's right. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? I did go in a hot cuisine place once, and I mean, it was ridiculous, like £125 for two meals, and this is going back like 20 years. And the main course came out. So what the heck is this? It was a massive plate the size of a table. But there was like, I think it was a little tiny bit of salmon on it, I think, with some drizzle of a sauce and some lettuce or something. I thought, what on earth? And then the pudding came out and I was equally disappointed because I like a big pudding. You know, don't call me Paul Puddings for nothing. Nobody calls me Paul Puddings.
That could be a gangster.
I could be a gangster of Paul Puddings. But yeah, so, and it came big bowl, but little tiny pudding. Mm. And it was one of them with the, like a creme brulee sort of thing, where they burn the top, that's what I'm saying.
It's any time burning things is appropriate.
Yeah, yeah, it smelled nice, but there wasn't much in it. Does anybody else have anything else they want to pick up on? What about sort of Marty and Fitzgerald?
Oh, yeah, I really struggle with, like, highly pretentious characters, I can't lie, and he was...
Matt Golis plays that character really
wonderful.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was like a laconic Elliot Gould, brilliant.
And he comes in, you get the impression that he's half plastered when he comes in as well. Like.
I mean,
because he's like a bit, do I even know where I am?
Yeah. you hate to know him in real life, but to watch him in this film is just glorious.
Yeah, it's like I love him but hate him at the same time.
But yeah, I mean, going back to that theme of the old and the new, Ken says to got a line to Sean as well, hasn't he? That's a nice line.
Oh, I just noticed that.
When did it all change? When did eating dinner become a Broadway show?
Mm.
It's talking about everybody's. It's all performative, and I think that's Fitzgerald's thing. Eating's sort of a performance, like an art world performance, isn't it? It's not.
It's quite theatrical everything.
And
the mockery of the mockery of the waitresses kind of feels very theatrical as well on Fitzgerald's part. I think
it's like, who cares what you're saying? But you obviously care what you're saying, like so much, and the people around have to pretend to care what you're saying as well. Like, what a wonderful observation!
The way they sit at the head of the table, and it's like, you're not my friend, you're my audience.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he has got a great line when he says he's talking about one of them is looking at the painting. One of his entourage is looking at the painting in the restaurant, which are Marty's paintings. He says, you look at the paintings in restaurants, do you look at the cheese tray in galleries? I like that line. That's a good line. I thought that was a good one.
Yeah, that did make me smile.
And also when Louis says to... He's talking to Is it Carmen he's talking to? He says, the people here only listen to themselves. I think Fitzgerald's a good example of that again, isn't he? You know, he's performing for his audience, if you like, which is to say he's performing for the high society sort of art people, art folks that he's got at the table. Unaware that the person that he's condescending to, Marty, is herself an artist. And bless her, I like Marty. I think she's a great character. I want to see a sequel to this with Marty.
Didn't he say he offered to leave his card or something? He said, I'll leave me a tip on Paul.
Yeah, something along those lines, yeah.
I think that kind of... Like back's ass. It's like wouldn't be expecting that kind of.
But again, it's the whole sort of. I think the dialogue sparkles with that sort of back and forth, doesn't it? I think in this movie, I think
the thing with the multiple threads, the narratives, and all those things, it works really well because it's not done in like a trite sort of Magnolia sort of way where it's like a unique selling point of the movie that
very organic.
Yeah, exactly, organic. But like, I don't know, The Big Chill or something. It's witnessing life going on, and life doesn't go on in neatly segmented sort of one act, thing going on at a time. You know, so it works rather because a lot of the reaction to the film concentrates on the multi narratives and things, and you might go to it expecting something like Magnolia, where it all comes together at the end, and the police detective being there is probably the closest it gets to that, maybe, that is a bit sort of neat or whatever. But it's designed,
Louis,
if you were in a restaurant, loads of stuff would be happening,
I think it all feels very, it gels, I think, very well. I think, and there's threads that you want to know more about. I still don't see what all the ladies see in Udo. I see, she, he's what, like, my wife would call him not just a knobhead, an absolute knobhead. I think Udo. He's sort of very, you know, between you can
he's
see
a superstar, isn't he?
He's a superstar. He's got his name in the papers, and I think, you know, between him and I like the relationship between him. Well, Louis and Udo, and Louis and Duncan, because Duncan's much more like a son to Udo to Louis than Udo is, I think. Because Udo just makes demands. He's entitled. He says, "I want the restaurant, Dad." You know, sort of. This is going to be my business one day. So there's a lot of assumptions in there. Why don't you just give it to? Sorry?
It's like rude. Like, can't just come in and demand the business.
But he does, doesn't he? Yeah. This is when you can hand it over to me. And Duncan's, you know, what you call the grafter, isn't he? Just each works, and he's, you know. He's the thing that, and at the end of the movie, after the Carmen and Paolo have been whacked by Ken, Louis sends Duncan away from pain, and he urges Nicole to go with him, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, that's what I was going to say. The ending was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. You know, how can a double murder feel so sweet and lovely? It's a beautiful family moment where they carve the turkey or something.
They too just... were what my wife would call absolute knobheads. Yeah. Carmen and Paolo. I mean, there's nothing you can't wish. They're like rabid dogs. There's nothing else you could do with them, is there? They'll just keep coming and coming and coming and coming for Duncan and the business. And, you know, it's the only thing you can.
It's the only way.
It's the only way, yeah. It's the mob way, isn't it, I suppose? Yeah,
It was just such a beautiful ending. Whether it was because, obviously, you know, John Corbett was hanging around at the end, but it was just lovely. So lovely, sweet ending, you know.
And then at the end, Louis says to Gary, "Revenge is a dish best eaten cold," and Gary corrects him, "Revenge is best served cold." And I think I'm trying to sort of, that's the last thought, that's the epiphany at the end of that story, but I don't quite know what the misunderstanding really signifies.
It's just a cool thing to...
Yeah,
but again, is it suggesting that he's not really a gangster because he's got the quip one-liner sort of wrong right at the end? So if he was a proper gangster, he'd get that right.
Yeah, it's a bit like the ending of Last Boy Scout, isn't it? When Bruce Willis is trying to teach the other character. He's trying to teach him about the sort of the action movie Shane Black script. You know, the action movie one-liner. He said, "You hit somebody with a surfboard." He said, "Surf's up, buddy." And it's sort of like the one-liner at the end of The Murder of Carmen and Paolo in this, but Louis gets it wrong, and he's undercut. I suppose it's a theme of undercutting that sort of vision of what gangsterism is, I guess. Because he's clearly a gangster. He's had somebody whacked. He's had two guys whacked in the toilets. You know, he's arranged for the detective to be there. You know, there's nothing more criminal than that, is there, really? It's all organised. It's not just organised crime. You know, he's been involved in bookmaking, not bookkeeping. But he denies it all by, you know, that final sort of gesture. And you think, well, he might have been a gangster in his time. He claims not to have 25 years.
Well, it seemed more like his partner in the car that was...
Gary, the accountant.
Maybe he had the real connections to actually do the murder.
And Enrico at the start as well.
Yeah, he seemed more like an accountant, the way he handled the whole...
Yeah, because Gary's involved because he blocks the stairway, doesn't he, for the detective's wife. He sort of puts his leg up and she's, "Oh, how rude." But and then he said he could go down now. So she's the detective's wife's the character that finds her.
Yeah. I mean,
body.
I might not have, you know, I might have missed it all just because I was looking at John throughout the whole film, but I got the impression that the owner was generally not really a gangster, and that he'd played up to it maybe enough to meet the right people. So this final gesture to get everything set off in the new chapter could all be tied up that way.
Yeah, I think my way of looking at it was that it's like what makes somebody really a gangster, you know? Because
I suppose mafia is the thing, because he plays on the idea that he's got mafia connections. So maybe he never was part of the family. He was never part of the mafia. Maybe he was a bit of a gangster, but not a mafia.
Yeah, but mafia is just organised crime, isn't it? So yeah, well, it's a bit like, you know, it's like it's that erosion of the difference between sort of legitimate... I mean, like, corporate greed is gangsterism, isn't it? You know, this is the thing about, you know, going back to that theme of the intertwining, the interweaving of the legitimate and the illegitimate, is that if a corporation or a criminal organisation acts against humanity, then technically, in my mind, the gangsters.
Yeah,
do you know
yeah we've never encountered any gangsters like at that. All.
But you know, this is it's something that that essay that I wrote for that Cosa Nostra box set, the Franco Nero box set, the Damiani films, sort of the conclusion of that was about that very topic. And I think I see that in Dinner Rush is if legitimate business and gangsterism, the modelled on they often follow the same models, but it's the extent to which they act against humanity, I think, that defines them as being gangsters or not. Do you know what I mean? So, and a lot of corporations are gang. Back off, Paul. Back off.
Did you not find though? You know the beginning, the murder at the beginning,
yeah,
his partner, and then he's there identifying him. Weirdly, the way it was shot, I thought I was watching NYPD Blue for a minute. I was like, "Whoa, what that's talking about." But and the fact that he was there to identify him, not his daughter.
Yeah.
The police are aware of that. That tied into the mob thing for me a little bit. Like, gave it that sort of thing that he'd got. He was more into it than perhaps he was admitting. Maybe.
And,
I don't know.
And I think the other thing is what I like about the confidence that Duraldi. I mean, it's somebody that's made sort of TV commercials and music videos and a couple of TV movies. But the confidence, the way that he handles the aftermath from that, and I like that Louis goes to see Natalie and Lucy, and they have that moment, and he hugs Natalie, and this is before he's got that weird intentions with his friend, sort of grieving daughter, but we'll leave
escalated
that to
so quickly.
That's a bit later in the narrative. But he hugs Natalie, and they go in, and Duraldi cuts to Lucy, the little girl, looking up or looking at Louis and her mother off screen, and then you just get that moment of quiet, and he holds it for long enough for that sort of close up of Lucy to sink in, and you can hear street noises in the background. There's a pneumatic drill, isn't there, in the background, roadworks being carried out, and then you cut to that really upbeat piece of music. That and those sort of street shots in a Tribeca. And I think the confidence of that, I think it's really sort of standout filmmaking. I think to go from such a to have the confidence to hold that moment of quiet for so long, and then to cut from that like quite a scene of people grieving, moment of quiet, close up of a child's face, and then to that sort of upbeat music, which is all about. And it gives that sense of community, I think, and sort of, and that's what it is. And it's really that territorialism, and it's the indie being the independent being absorbed by the corporation. I think, and that's what it's about. Isn't it?
One of the reviews, Emmanuel Levy, says a quintessentially New York film that recalls indie movies of the 1980s, and I think it's an interesting. But what it made me think of. Films like Trees Lounge,
yeah,
and I haven't really seen them, but there's a couple of films. Are they called like Smoke or something? Where it's
Smoke
set in
and Blue in the Face,
set in a tobacconist sort of thing.
Yeah,
those hubs of community and
yeah,
that's what it gave me a feel of.
Yeah. I like it. There's I've owned a restaurant in Tribeca, dealt with a mob. But there's a sense of nostalgia there, I think, isn't there, for a time it was a...
But life going on as well, the next chapters and,
I really liked Dinner Rush. Yeah, any final thoughts? Nikki?
I surprisingly enjoyed it. It's not something I would have picked myself. Like you say, when you look at the artwork online, it's a bit like something you'd find in a bargain bin.
Which is where the DVD was, to be fair, over here.
Yeah. So. But no, I surprisingly enjoyed it. It became quite... sort of absorbed by it,
but
I think it's because it was that fast pace, kind of what's going to happen next, the depth of the story.
And so nicely lit and shot as well, considering how much low light, and that restaurant's quite an impressive. It's got the bare plaster on the walls and stuff. And somebody says at one point, it's just like being in Italy, doesn't it? As they come in, but it's really well shot, I think, and the fact that the editing manages to keep these separate things. These separate events and separate narrative threads distinct,
Yeah.
I mean, they all interlink, but the, you know, it never becomes confusing, I don't think, where we are in time and place. Sorry, Peter, was you going to say, do you have any final thoughts?
Final thoughts? John Corbett, call me.
Do you know what? We should just do a podcast of John Corbett.
Yeah.
John Corbett films and TV appearances by Peter.
I'll take you on my boat. It'll be beautiful.
I don't know where to go from there. I think we need a moment of quiet, just like the start of the film. Yeah, say tatty bye, kids, then.
Tatty bye, kids.
Tatty bye, kids.
Tatty bye.